You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. Light our chalice today as a symbol of the abundance of our lives as they come together as one church. In this sanctuary, we harvest strength from one another and offer our crop to the world with hands of compassion and charitable generosity. In our authentic and gentle connection with one another, we cultivate the strength of spirit to bless not just ourselves, but all the world. May we be grateful for this hallowed time together that sustains and nourishes us, and so enables us to sustain and nourish others who may have need of the abundance and strength we cultivate here. Well, good morning and welcome to our service of worship. It is a service because it means to serve you, and it is worship because it raises to worth things that matter. My name is Rob McPherson, the minister of this church, and I welcome you here on behalf of generations of Unitarians who have worshipped in similar gatherings in South Australia since 1854. We are a spiritual community that encourages and supports all who come to find, to fashion, and mostly importantly, to follow their own spiritual path. Any path that helps you see more clearly, love more abundantly, and work toward a better world for all. You are invited to kick on with us after the service for coffee, tea, and conversation. Let's join together in singing our opening hymn, "For Everyone Born, a Place at the Table." It's just three verses today, Brendan. Please stand as you're able.
This is reading from A Course in Miracles by Helen Schumann. We're all familiar with the phrase, give till it hurts. Yet a recent scientific study shows that giving really feels good. The brain registers positive feelings not only when you give to another person, but can even do so when you witness giving from a source other than yourself. This finding dovetails nicely with the fundamental teaching that giving is receiving. The study centered on an arena of giving that seems to hurt for just about everybody: giving money. The study showed that most of the subjects experienced positive warm glow feelings, revealed by brain scans, when they voluntarily gave to the food bank. Economists regard this voluntary giving as not wholly altruistic, because they speculate that the giver gives not wholly out of selflessness, but to make herself feel good. However, some subjects exhibited what economists called pure altruism. They felt that warm glow not just when they gave, but also when the computer took money from them to give to the food bank. They even felt better when the computer put additional money in the food bank account than they did when it put additional money into their own account. They cared more about money going to benefit others than money that benefited themselves. Dr. Ulrich Mayer, one of the three researchers who created this study, found this result especially remarkable. The most surprising result is that these basic pleasure centres in the brain don't respond only to what's good for yourself. They also seem to be tracking what's good for other people. And this occurs even when the subjects don't have a say in what happens. Presumably because of all these warm feelings, the subjects who displayed pure altruism were a lot more generous to the food bank. They gave twice as much as the subjects who only felt good when they gave voluntarily. This study seems to provide evidence for a universal law. To give and to receive are one. In other words, whatever you give, whether it be an extension of loving kindness or a vicious attack, you yourself will receive in some form, whether tangible or simply an experience in your own mind. If we really let this idea sink in, we have all the motivation in the world to give only things that we really want to receive.
Thank you, John. In light of the most recent tsunami in Indonesia, we've restarted our Shelter Box campaign to provide survival resources for families who have lost literally everything. It's alas the second such effort we've had to make collectively in the last few months for our closest neighboring nation. We've raised funds for Shelter Boxes before, sometimes raising thousands, but last time, gotta tell you, the results were a little disappointing. It occurred to me then that maybe we collectively need to do some collective prayerful discernment about the charitable giving we do or don't do as a united church. I mean, after all, charitable giving is one of the cornerstone spiritual practices of all the world's major religions, every one. I mean, its purpose is not just to flagellate yourself and be masochistic, of course. And charitable giving is not a substitute for creating social justice, which aims to undo the systemic causes of inequality and therefore the need for charity. Nor is charity optional for people who profess to follow their particular tradition, be it tzedakah for Jews, zakat for Muslims, dana for Buddhists, or alms for Christians. It's not actually an option extra in any of these major traditions. It's a foundational pillar, except in the Unitarian tradition. Our fundamental commitment to individual freedom argues against collective spiritual practice, and so leaves charitable giving up to the private discretion of each member. Yet somehow, the food basket's a norm in our collective worship. I don't know how or when it started. But I don't ever recall being asked if the church wanted to align itself consistently and exclusively with a particular Christian charity, the Moore Street Mission in this case. Effective and laudable though their work certainly is locally. I mean, we also sell Oxfam goodies, and so contribute to the good work Oxfam does globally. It may surprise you to learn that many Unitarian churches do two collections. One to sustain the church itself, and one to support a charitable cause that they, as a church, have decided to align themselves with. This second charity collection offers both the opportunity to practice in a tangible way, loving your neighbor as yourself, but it also sends a potent signal about the church's public identity. Because by strategically partnering with this or that charity, a church makes a clear public statement about its values and the truth of its commitment to them. Our church has taken a more off-and-on, scattered, random, ad hoc approach, depending on an urgent need arising or simply getting attention, and depends on individual members willing to drive it. Over its long history, the Unitarian Church of South Australia has supported a mind-boggling variety of charitable causes. During my brief tenure here alone, we've raised funds and done service for the Vincentian Center, the Australian Church's Refugee Task Force, that's where a lot of the Spring Fair money went, the Moore Street Mission, as I mentioned, the Hutt Street Day Center, Shelter Box, Oxfam, and the One Girl Do It in a Dress campaign. I am probably leaving some out, apologies, but you get the idea. Our approach has been random, mixing the local and the global, addressing needs ranging from basic survival to higher education. Now, the Unitarian churches who do charity differently are rather more intentional and disciplined about it. They take a collective approach that requires collective discernment, identifying needs they feel are good to address and that they can have an impact on, reflecting on their values, gauging member interest, and then raising charitable giving to worth as part of worship. Of course, your own individual charitable giving also says things about your personal values and who you believe is your neediest neighbor or the one you can do the most good for. And of course, I'm aware that many of us prefer to do our giving anonymously and in private, to do good by stealth and blush to find it fame, as Alexander Pope put it. But I'm going to ask you to risk a blush or two in some buzz time today. Would you be prepared to share just quietly with people around you what charitable causes you give to or have given to, either in money or in service? Now, don't break your arm patting yourself on the back, and it's no problem if you prefer not to, but see how you go for a couple of minutes. Okay, thank you. Now consider this more important follow-up question. What might your, just if you had to think about it and hear from other people, we don't have to be completist about this, particularly in the time factor. What might your choice of charity say about what you value, what you raise to worth? For example, if I supported Wells for India, which ensures sanitary water for the poorest of the poor in provinces where 95% of the groundwater is polluted, and multinationals like Coke and Nestle are trying to privatize all the clean subsurface water, it might suggest that I value sanitary water as a human right, and that trumps the right of corporations to profit. So again, no pressure, but see how you go with this one. Okay, that's good. Thank you. And thank your neighbors. Thank your neighbors for their candor and their listening. Nice to have a little buzz time up at the front. Thank your neighbors. Neighbor's a great word. Neighbor means those who are nigh or close physically to you. Those who can benefit directly from your actions rather than, say, thoughts and prayers at a distance. So the question becomes, in a globalized world, who is my neighbor? Whose needs might I be able to have an actual beneficial impact upon? How much distance is too far away to matter? Well, maybe there is no such thing as too far. Loving your neighbor as yourself has, as the reading pointed out, a metaphysical basis, that we are all connected. Something our seventh principle expresses. That's the one that goes around the wheel, the interdependence of all existence. So what we do and what we don't do for others rebounds on us, as this hymn expresses. We'll sing it now. Please stand as you're able. Now look, it would be safe to assume that none of us would be here if we weren't to some degree basically altruistic. If not, you've come to the wrong shop, really. And we will do good for our neighbor when and as ever we can, but we do live in cynical times, my friends. I mean, most of our news is by definition bad news, or it wouldn't be news. So when charities make headlines, it's usually not about their mundane day-to-day altruism, the good that they do, but mostly when they fail to live up to our expectations of them. Or prove to be flat-out scams. We each also have our own personal biases and a certain moral competitiveness. So we might be inclined to look for reasons why this charity or that charity is maybe a little less worthy of our support than the one we believe in. Everybody loves to have the dirt on do-gooders, their inefficiency, their unexpected outcomes, their occasional bad faith. I'll tell you what, if you do find one that's whiter than white, cleaner than clean, do let us all know. This cultural cynicism is evident even in the one-on-one, in-your-face street level. I mean, think about the last time you were approached by a charity mugger, or chugger, as they're called now, or even a beggar. Regardless of whether you gave them anything or not, was not at least part of your inner dialogue something like this? But how do I know this will actually address someone's real need? What we seem to fear in this most is not so much the loss of the dollar as the loss of face, of being a well-intentioned fool. But that, my friends, is ego talking. The ego wants control, and the end outcome of charity is always beyond our control. What you gave to the chugger, the charity mugger, may get eaten up in administration costs. The beggar may spend it on drugs, or worse, alcohol. Indeed, they may. So charitable giving is at base a risk, which means it's an act of faith, and is a spiritual practice precisely because it transcends the ego's desire for control. So altruism and cynicism wrestle perpetually for our souls, and it is hard to be both reflexively generous and at the same time never ever duped. But do you want to be right all the time, or do you want to be a generous soul? And generous especially when one's neighbor's needs for survival basics like food, shelter, warmth, medicine, and clothing are really acute. I mean, some needs are more basic than others. We spend a lot of energy as a church meeting our needs for belonging and self-esteem. That's around the middle of Maslow's hierarchy. And these needs are real and genuine. It's part of our community building and, you know, the great vibe we have around here. But those needs are of a higher order than physical and safety needs. We spend a lot of energy as a church seeking self-actualization. That's way up the pyramid in a variety of ways. But it is hard to seek for these higher needs when you are homeless or sick or starving. So I think it might be good for us as one united church to pull our collective head out of its own navel and see which neighbors, that wasn't my first draft, and see which neighbors the Unitarian Church of South Australia can help just survive with some dignity. Our collective power would address more need than your individual giving. And regularizing our giving would focus our scattered efforts and increase our impact. And through an ongoing partnership with a particular charity or two, we would proclaim to all the community that we not only have certain values, but we undertake to live up to them. We might get a reputation as, you know, a church. It stands for altruism over cynicism, but look, it's easy to get sucked in by cynicism. I easily can fall prey to it. For example, years ago now, we raised through an event called the CEO Sleepout between $2,000 and $3,000 for the Vincentian Center, the only emergency shelter for homeless men in the metro area. It has 50 beds for around 1,400 rough sleepers on average in this city. $10 gets a guy a hot meal, a hot shower, and a warm bed for one night. So we met someone's basic needs for maybe 300 nights. Now, this was my own initiative, and I certainly felt supported by the church, hence the amount. A couple of $1,000 is a lot of money for us. But after two goes, I abandoned it because I felt the event itself was a cynical exercise. And lately, I've been wondering if I wasn't just projecting my own cynicism in that judgment. I mean, after all, you know, food, hygiene, a safe place to sleep. I was hungry and you fed me. I was a stranger and you took me in rather than left me out in the cold. How can even the most ill-conceived, ham-fisted event not be redeemed just a little bit by delivering such things to those who need them? And Vinny's did and do. I realize I even went into the event looking for things to reinforce my pre-existing view that rich folks slumming it was in bad faith and in really bad taste. There's plenty of fodder for my cynicism in the midst of all that showy altruism. I mean a sleep out for CEOs. By this we mean like law partners, senior public servants, business owners, and one clergy. It was more like a private school camp for grown-ups complete with fake hardship, softened by public liability laws, and insulated with the body fat of a well-nourished life of privilege. I mean, if the sleep out were genuine hardship, CEOs wouldn't do it. Everybody knew nothing would hurt, or at least not for very long, and if it did, it wouldn't be anything that a hot bath and a large scotch wouldn't cure anyway. A sleep out for a night, even the longest, coldest, wettest night of the year, which is when they're planned, meant to give the overprivileged a taste of the hard, basic, persistent needs of the homeless, that sleep out is not homelessness itself, despite what this ad says. And despite its very good intentions, ends up looking like a cruel mockery of homelessness. I mean, around you are all this high-end North Face and Helly Hansen gear. Factory fresh cardboard, straight from the Visi factory. And a show bag they give you full of food, water, torches, CEO sleep-out logoed cold weather merch like a beanie and a scarf and gloves. And of course, networking flyers and business cards for the various companies represented. Plus, authentic homeless food and hot beverages served all night long, but served by people who had actually been formerly homeless themselves. Just the fact that there were plenty of clean, well-lighted toilets pretty much put paid to the idea that this was going to mirror in any way the experience of those who sleep rough as a way of living. The evil genius of targeting CEOs was threefold. First, who has more liberal white guilt to offload than the very publicly rich? Second, who would compete most fiercely to raise the most charity money? Who would be the fairest of them all? I mean, surprise, competitive people compete. They've already gotten to the top of the greasy corporate ladder. And third, who would have networks of underlings they could put the squeeze on than people at the top of a hierarchy? Give the boss a bone. And that's the answer. CEOs, business owners, top bureaucrats. There was a video leaderboard, and a couple of bank CEOs came out on top, as apparently they always do. And of course, feeling like a spy as the only clergy present, I interviewed some of them, and they all gave the same PR humble brag about wanting to do their bit to help the less fortunate. I mean, if there was the slightest awareness that they were a key part of an economic system that necessitates homelessness as the one remaining spook story to tell your kids, work hard, be thankful for that paycheck, and keep your nose clean or you'll end up on the street. If there was any sense that they were part of that, I didn't sense it. Maybe they can't fix the system. Maybe they don't want to. Maybe they know they're powerless to, but if they can't, who can? And we all raised a lot of money on that night, $250,000, which would offer precisely nothing that wasn't a Band-Aid. $250,000 won't buy another 50 beds in the CBD. $250,000 won't buy a decent two-bedroom flat in the CBD. No, this was virtue signaling for capitalists with other people's money. When I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. If I ask why the poor have no food, they call me a communist. Futility, therefore, was the icing on this cake of bad faith, and before I knew it, any altruism I carried into the event had been wrestled to the mat by cynicism, and I tapped out. I went to sleep on the ground with those who were part of the problem we were trying to address. But when I woke, in the first rosy streaks of dawn over the hum of a gently rousing city, I saw something that gave me one of those sharp, tender shocks that means your thinking has become really uptight. Because all around me, huddled in their expensive goose-down swags and Ankaparinga blankets and orthopedic pillows, these strangers slept on and dreamt. Their faces as soulful and gentle as children at prayer. In sleep, they were no longer big shots, just a little heap of flesh and bone swaddled in a twist of cloth, clinging to a small patch of earth for the safe and innocent sleep we all need. That momentary vulnerability disappeared the pomp and glory of their office and made me, I confess it, love each and every one of them. I couldn't help it. Everyone is beautiful when they sleep. The yielding surrender to it, all the masks of good and bad, of altruism and cynicism, fallen away. They're like children again. And herein, perhaps, were they like the homeless people they had perhaps sincerely undertaken to help, equal in basic needs like safety, warmth, food, rest. I began to feel my cynicism evaporate like the morning's dew. There's always this in waking, the split second of bewilderment when you are neither awake nor asleep. Do you know that moment? When for a moment you don't know where you are, what's happening, why you are where you are, even who you are. You're not yourself, you just are, discovering awareness again. You know, and soon, of course, consciousness kicks back in and your identity and place and purpose in the world comes flooding back. You're rebooted, like being reborn. Now, if you were to take that momentary waking bewilderment and stretch it out into all that you know. That is the reality the homeless live with all the time, belonging nowhere, having no reason to be anywhere, being no one. Love your neighbor as yourself, we're told. Neighbor means those who are nigh, close, those you come into contact with, those you can see and touch and hear and smell, even those rich folk sleeping and dreaming all around me that morning. It is far easier to be cynical at a distance when your neighbor is an abstraction. But I found out that loving your neighbor means even loving your rich and sated CEO neighbor, whose hearts also throb with the simplest of Maslow's needs, just like you, just like everybody. And I thought, God damn it. Damn my jaded heart. Maybe this was a good idea after all. Maybe they're smarter than I thought. Maybe it wasn't all about the money, but the sleeping and the bewildered waking together in a strange and open place with strangers. Did they mean for us to see each other like this? I was reminded of this little poem by T.E. Hume, The Fantasia of a Fallen Gentleman on a Cold Winter Night. I saw this plastered on a wall in an underpass in the darkest days of Thatcher's Britain. Once in finesse of fiddles found I ecstasy, in the flash of gold heels on the hard pavement. But he's a fallen gentleman. But now I see that warmth's the very stuff of poetry. O God, make small the old star-eaten blanket of the sky, that I may fold it round me and in comfort lie. No, these folks weren't homeless. They were glamping. I know that. Awaiting us all were warm, lavish homes, loving arms, and a hot breakfast. But it is a little easier to imagine being homeless when we touch our material vulnerability, even for a moment, to be surprised by a true taste of it. Made hungry ourselves, even for a pre-breakfast morning, we might be more likely to share the bone. And it was I'm ashamed to admit, I, the one clergy who might have been the most cynical person there, in my sneaking contempt and suspicion of these rich folks. Wealth puts blinders on you just like poverty does. They're just better blinders. The rich are allowed to be stupid and venal and self-seeking, just as the poor are. I offer this story of my cynicism about an easily dismissible charitable act and the moderating of my cynicism, not to plug Vinny's particularly, but as a cautionary tale against reflexive cynicism about us choosing a charity or two as a church. What we choose might not be perfect, might not be to everybody's taste, but it would be a shame to let the perfect become the enemy of the good. Because I'm going to ask you to consider this and see if anyone wants to make a proposal for the annual general meeting this year. Should not this church collectively collect for a charity or two as part of worship? And if so, which ones would reflect our values and have an impact on the most acute needs of our neighbors? And if not, why on earth not? Reflect on this and discuss it with those here today at coffee time and others absent today. We have many weeks to go before the AGM. I'll be interested to hear your views as we approach the AGM in November, at which we might formally endorse an ongoing charitable cause or two as a united church. Because we do have neighbors who hunger for altruism. They already have a belly full of cynicism. Amen.
This is a song about downtown Los Angeles on 5th Street. All the people there affectionately refer to it as the nickel. It's kind of a hobo's lullaby. Sticks and stones can break my bones, but I always will be true. And when your mama's dead and gone, I'll sing this lullaby just for you. So what becomes of little boys who never comb their hair? They're lined up all around the block on the nickel over there. So if you chew tobacco, you wish upon a star, you find out where the scarecrows sit. Man, they look like punchlines between the cars. And I know a place where a royal flush can never beat a pair. And even Thomas Jefferson is on the nickel over there. So ring around the rosy, you're sleeping in the rain. You're always late for supper. Man, you let me down again. Thought I heard a mockingbird Roosevelt knows where. They're whistling past the graveyard. They're on the nickel over there. So what becomes of little boys who run away from home? The world just keeps getting bigger once you get out on your own. So climb up through that buttonhole and fall right up the stairs. I'll show you where the short dogs grow on the nickel over there.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.